Okay, good evening. Good to see everyone again. It's been something like 5-6 weeks. People had hopefully substantial, enjoyable breaks and are now having also substantial, enjoyable learning experiences in their semesters. Just experiences of different types. Okay, the topic for tonight, the halachic status of lab-grown meats. This was really exciting. It was a very exciting topic. And a topic which is exceedingly contemporary, right? We've talked about some, you know, relatively contemporary issues, relatively modern issues. Here we're looking at things that are, like, this is, if you want to watch cutting-edge halacha, like, as it's happening, and not only retrospectively, this is an issue to watch. Someone sent me, just earlier today, a letter from the Chief Rabbi of Israel, which came out last week, where he's weighing in on some of these issues. The picture you have in the front of these sources, let's say starting from the left of the image, are three of the most important halachic voices in sort of the broader, like, modern Orthodox halachic world. So in order of sitting around that table are Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon, who's the chief rabbi of Gush Etzion in Israel, and involved in a lot of really exciting and interesting educational projects and halachic projects there. Rav Asher Weiss, a former, a Kloisenberger chassid, who also ended up becoming a very well-respected voice in contemporary halacha, even in the more modern communities in Israel. You don't often see chassidim walking around the Hezder yeshivot in Israel, but he's there, and he's giving shiurim, including once I had the pleasure of hearing him when I was at Gush. It was a treat having someone of his caliber there. And Rav Herschel Schechter, who's the senior Rosh Yeshiva at YU, one of the more important poskim based in America. They're looking now at lab-grown chicken in this picture. Like, this is a picture that was sent to a WhatsApp group I was in about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and they're dealing with some of the work being done at some of these farms also. So really, this is halacha in the trenches, please. So it's very exciting to kind of watch that develop. Now, because of that, there are a couple of caveats we'll have to give in the shiur, because it's necessarily a kind of dynamic topic, so I'm not sure where some of the issues that we're going to discuss are going to land in 5 or 10 years. But where we are now, we'll try to get a snapshot of the lay of the land, even if it's not necessarily a comprehensive one. First, just to get some background and define some of our terms. So we're going to be talking about lab-grown meat. It's also known as clean meat or cultured meat, not in the sense of like high culture, but in the sense that it's being cultivated in a lab context. In Hebrew, basar miturbat or basar mitae gezar, stem cells, so stem cell meat. You have different terms for these kinds of things. This sort of popped into the public consciousness about 10 years ago in 2013, less than 10 years ago, when the first lab-grown burger was produced and eaten. At the time, each burger cost around $300,000. My understanding is that the price has come down very significantly since then, to the point where you have people predicting that within the year, you'll start seeing lab-grown meat available in stores. It might not be the most affordable package or the most affordable product out there, but it'll be available as an option for people who, for whatever reason, might be interested in the product. The way the process works, and there are a bunch of asterisks here about different factories, how they do things differently, but broadly speaking, some genetic material from some animal is collected, sometimes from stem cells, sometimes even from the cells of living animals, muscle tissue. It seems that it's even possible with inorganic type tissues, or the idea of, like, say, feathers or hair of different animals. They're able to process those cells in what is often referred to delicately as a serum of whatever kinds of chemicals and biological compounds that they produce. A lot of it often currently involves blood of various animals. And through this sort of chemical process, they're able to get the cells to multiply, first to become the kind of muscle tissue we want, and then to multiply very rapidly to the point where you produce a substantial piece of meat, which then, in the way of all kinds of factory or industrial products, is, you know, manipulated in whatever ways to make it look and feel like the real thing, even more than it already does. For example, often the original product looks white, and you want it to look red, like a nice piece of, you know, red meat if you're eating a burger, so you have to color it a little bit. There are various kinds of additives that also get involved into this process. Now, because of some of the asterisks that were mentioned, like where exactly the protein comes from, what is in the serum that is being used to raise these animals, is the meat being taken, or are the cells being taken from a live animal, a shechted animal, a fetus? Each of these things might lead to different halakhic conclusions. So that's one reason why it's going to be very hard to come to any kind of firm answer to some of our questions today. A second reason is that I'm not a posig, and so I can't give you a firm answer on what is currently a live, contentious topic, on which there is no consensus, on which some leading people, like my teacher, Rabbi Menachem Ganak, the CEO of the OU's Kashrus division, has been changing his mind on some of these issues as he gets more data and as he finds out more about the process. And the second reason we won't be able to get to very clear conclusions. So our goal instead for today is going to try to highlight some of the issues at play, some of the live factors that a posig will have to engage with, both to highlight the ways that poskim will search for precedent for what are otherwise unprecedented situations or opportunities that we have, and the complexity of applying precedent and how precedent is often a very subtle kind of beast where it's very hard to find a perfect match in traditional halakha to contemporary live situations, and any imperfect match is going to be difficult to apply perfectly. And you'll have people who say, well, these two scenarios aren't quite similar enough, so I can't apply from one to the other. Before we do all of that, I want to try to just touch on a little bit, and maybe you'll help me tease out some of these details. I think this issue has sort of piqued people's fascination in a lot of different interesting ways. And I've been thinking a little bit about why, like why people care so much about this, both pragmatically, like what is it doing for us? Why is it helpful if we're able to engage with these this technology halakhically? And why it's so philosophically interesting to people? Like, what are people either curious about or bothered by when they think about this as something that our society might be doing in the next 3 to 5 years? So I'll start with that as a question. Like, why does this matter? Why is this helpful if we're able to do it, or harmful if we do it wrong? What's at play?
I think if the process is relatively simple, it can be a lot cheaper in the long run.
Economics, big factor. It could be cheaper. It started out much more expensive. It could end up getting cheaper. Exactly, right? The technology has to be developed. And especially for kosher consumers, where we don't get all the meat of every cow that we shecht, first of all, you have to shecht it, so there's a manpower cost. Then the back half of the animal is basically not, you know, usable because of the various nerves and fats that would have to be removed that are not economically or halakhically advisable. And then you want the meat to be glatt, so you lose even more. So it becomes very difficult to get kosher meat, and that's why kosher meat is so expensive. So if you can make it cheaper kosher meat, that's a big factor. Excellent. Economics. What else is a consideration at play? And kind of why we care about this.
There's, of course, like the moral standpoint of it. Like, a lot of people have problems with killing live animals, so this would, this would be the best alternative to a veggie burger. Essentially.
Right, if you want to be ethical, so I don't want to kill animals to eat them, I just want to eat them. If I don't want to kill them, that'd be great. I think the moniker that you use matters a lot, right? The people who call it clean meats are leaning into that. Mm-hmm. So, right, the ethical consideration is a big factor also in motivating us. Other sort of hashkafic, philosophical considerations might matter here, or practical ones.
Maybe what it means for, like, moving forward, like,
you might have a hesitation about slippery slopes, right? I'm cloning meat, so okay. Everyone's excited about Parif hamburgers. Maybe pork is exciting. I heard someone giving a shiur about this, and he raised the chilling, but, example. Someone sold, genetically produced human flesh. Would we be comfortable with buying that? I think I see some grimaces, and I think the answer is probably no, but in terms of the ethics and in terms of the halacha, it's not necessarily so different.
I mean, the cow lab meat is it starts off with material from an actual cow.
Sure.
So
to take a stem cell from, one cell from a person, they can do it with hair. Take my hair and clone me into...
There's no way that would be kosher.
So we'll have to talk about it. It's not so clear that it wouldn't be kosher. Well, that's one of the halakhic factors we're going to look at. So I'm glad we got there. I'll raise one other argument in favor. I think the argument against is it's worrying, and it's worth thinking through some of those details. I think later in the semester, a little bit of a plug for May 2nd, we're doing gene editing. I think gene editing is also one of those issues that leads to slippery slope territories and where are the bounds of technology where we should not go further because of what it might do to our humanity. Really live and powerful questions there. Won't be explaining so many right now, but definitely worth exploring there. Probably one last factor that people care about is the environment. They say that the process of raising cattle and turning them into beef is a bigger polluter than all the cars and trucks in the world. So when balancing factors like that, if you could save that level of greenhouse emissions by doing this all in labs, it has a huge environmental impact. Something like over 90% reductions in greenhouse gases and things like that. So there are other like broader, you might call them like tikkun olam type values here, like broadly making the world better economically, ethically, environmentally, could all be factors in favor. And without thinking, you know, to just add details of the economic piece, I'm sorry, is also, forget being cheaper for me, you know, affluent kosher consumer in Chicago, but it makes meat much cheaper for people who are less advantaged, and it also frees up a lot of land to grow a lot of cheap other products. So there are lots of sort of trickle-down effects that may also be kind of useful here. So it's a little bit of a push to see how far we can take this and how expensive can we be. And the more expensive we can be, the better off for a lot of the reasons that we mentioned. Okay, so in terms of halakhic issues, like I said, we're going to be dealing with a selection or smattering of precedents. Even today, as I was continuing research, I found extra sources and extra poskim who are dealing with this in different ways. So this is going to be a little bit incomplete, but our goal is to see sort of going through the process and thinking through the legal issues you'll need to think through in order to come to a conclusion about this meat. And I think there are really three major questions you'd have to address in dealing with a product like this. Right? The first question is, the question we just raised, forget cow, can I make any meat like this? Can I take a cell from a pig or from a feudal pig or a pig hair and turn it into pork and eat that pork? It might be that only live animals, you know, are behemoth tmeya that you then can't kill and eat, but maybe animals that you grow in a lab don't have that same status. That may be a potential avenue here. A second question we'll have to ask is, okay, so ignoring impure animals, let's talk about a cow. So what cells can I take from a cow? Can I take muscle cells? Can I take stem cells? If I take cells from the animal while it's alive, is it Eivar Min HaChai? That would be a problem. And a lot of the methods that are being developed are right now using live cells. Is it possible that you could shecht an animal and take a cell right after it's been shechted? Probably, but that's not how it's being done right now. And would that need to be done in order to make it kosher? Right? If you told a company you're going to have to shecht it and then immediately start extracting cells from it, maybe companies are less likely to do that, and it might make it harder to get kosher certification for some of these things. And the third question, and I think the one that tickles people's halakhic imaginations most, is would the meat be meat, or would it be parv? Could I grow in a lab a burger and then put cheese on top of it and cook it and have a kosher cheeseburger? And that's the one that's going to be most exciting. It's also the one that, based on what I've seen, and we'll talk about why, is the most controversial. Meaning it's the one that's sort of the biggest live debate that's going on. But let's start from the beginning. So, okay, you're a scientist, you have your needle, you stick it into a cow, you extract some stem cells, you get to work. What relationship do those cells have to the cow that it came from? We probably have two or three options for how to think of it, right? One is we could think of the cells as meat. It is just beef. Like, you took a cell out of the muscle of a cow. This is a cow basar cell that has all the halakhic rules of meat associated with it. A second option would be to consider it a sort of derivative product, meaning it's not beef, but it's something that comes from beef. So that's a category in halakha known as yotzei, something that derives from something else. And if it derives from something else, it might not have all the same properties as the thing from which it is derived from. It could be that cells are nothing. Halakha doesn't know what a cell is, so I look at a syringe that is functionally empty or looks like it has maybe a little fluid in it. I don't know what it looks like. But that's not a real thing, so I can't say anything meaningfully halakhic about it. So let's take a look at how... Oh, sorry?
Yeah.
Yeah, please.
If you're saying that if you're taking a few cells and then growing a lot of this leftover meat from it, and only those few cells are considered actual meat, but everything else is just a derivative of it, then would it be considered carved or, I guess, able to be mixed with dairy because of, like,
okay, so two major issues, right? First of all, and these are excellent points that are coming up in these major postgame right now, right? Point number one is, okay, let's say I take out two cells. So now those two cells multiply and they become 2 million cells. Okay, so do those 2 million cells have the same status as the two that they came from? Or are they like a new creation? That's a really relevant question. And the second is, well, if they are a new creation, so do they nullify the cells that they came from, and now it's all just new. Or, like, theoretically, if I could eat those two cells, those are beef, but everything that came out is, like, a pariv beef-looking thing. It looks like basar, but it's not really basar. Yeah, so two, like, excellent questions to be thinking about, and we'll see if we can extract some answers from some of the sources we're looking at. So let's jump into some of the halakha sources. We'll be jumping around a little bit and not reading everything thoroughly in the interest of time, but also in the interest of getting a sort of broad view of what's being discussed. So this Gemara in Chulin on the bottom of the first page is basically a source that introduces the idea of Eiver Min HaChai. Eiver Min HaChai, and the more relevant halacha is actually called Basar Min HaChai. We know Eiver Min HaChai, that's the one that's sort of on our lists of mitzvot in our heads. That usually refers to sort of fuller limbs of an animal. Basar would just refer to any piece of meat that would come from an animal. Both Tanai mentioned it. Both Amorai mentioned in this Gemara, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, Rav Shimon ben Lakish, both agree that Eiver Min HaChai, limbs from a live animal, and Basar Min HaChai, meat from a live animal, are both prohibited. They just disagree about the source for where that halacha comes from. So one avenue, one obstacle we might face, you know, if we're working in a lab here, we're trying to justify these burgers, so taking the cells from a live animal. Sounds like it should be an Eiver Min HaChai problem. Sounds like I'm taking a limb, albeit a very small piece limb or a small piece of meat from an animal. And if I'm eating a very small piece of meat from an animal that's alive, I shouldn't be able to eat that very small thing. That seems to be an obstacle that we'll have to face. We might have ways around it. We might have different ways of thinking about the cells. That seems to be our initial problem. But we have at least a couple of possible solutions. Our first possible solution is alluded to in source number 3. This is a Rambam. Again, a lot of these sources are not sort of contemporaneous. I'm not going to all the primary sources or working them down. I'm trying to find clear articulations of principles. So this Rambam is articulating an important principle in source number 3. If you take a look and read it now. But the principle he's articulating is that certain non-edible parts of an animal don't have the rules, don't have the same status as basar. Right? If there's a problem here that revolves around the status of the meat being meat or being edible, well, if you eat the hoof of an animal, that's not edible. And Rambam says, in fact, you're not liable for eating the hoof of an animal or the horns of an ox. They're not food. So if they're not food, then the prohibitions associated with food don't apply to them, which makes them permitted to eat. So if you want to start dealing with this issue, we may want to think about where you're getting the cells from. Taking them from live muscle tissue might be more problematic, might be more of a basar min hachai issue. Taking from the horn of an animal or the hair of an animal might be a little bit more closer to being permitted. And that's where you might run into issues like treif animals. So you shave a pig, or you take some tweezers, you pluck some individual hairs, you get pig cells, and you could develop pork from them. Well, if they started not as meat cells, they started as inedible things, the halakhic equivalent of a pile of dirt. Well, if it's a halakhic equivalent of a pile of dirt, and then that dirt happens to become tasty over time, okay, it happened to become tasty over time. That's not a big deal. And that's why there are some postgame who would tell you, based on something like this, that, yeah, you can grow pork in a lab, either with hair, or even, this is a more extreme view, you have some taking, but it's a little bit more fringe, that even taking cells from a pig would lead you to that conclusion, which would be exciting, but seems to not be so mainstreamed.
Is the Rambam saying pater de rabbanan or pater de oraisa?
That's a fantastic question, right? And that just to sort of clarify this for context, right? There are certain things here that are going to be mutter mi de'oraita, but asur mi de'rabbanan. And certain things that would be mutter even on a rabbinic level and be completely permitted. Thank you for asking the question. I remember noticing that I wanted to look it up, and I don't remember looking it up, so I couldn't answer the question directly. But I'll tell you that for pragmatic purposes, it might not matter. Meaning, once you could bring down the level of prohibition from de'oraita to de'rabbanan, you're worlds closer to being able to permit this, right? If we're starting with that worst of de'rabbanan, and then we're going to nullify it, and then we're going to mix it with other things, and then we're going to add another two sfeikot, you could find ways of getting closer to mutter. So it's a step in the right direction, but you're right to note. By default, when I see the word putter, I assume it's still asur mi de'rabbanan. It's usually when you see in the Mishnah, for example. But it's a good place to continue looking. A third option, right? We talked about how you could start from an animal taking the cells from, you know, muscle tissue, which is closer to basar. You could take it from a horn. But there may be other ways of conceptualizing what's happening with these cells, meaning they might not have the status of where they came from at all. They might, for example, be what's called yotzei. That's reflected in this Mishnah, Masechet Bechorot. The Mishnah says, if a behema tahora, sheyolda kamin behema tmeya, mutar ba'achila, if you have a cow that gives birth, mazel tov, but the cow, it's so embarrassing, it's a donkey. Oh my God, what's going on? So it's very embarrassing for the cows, but halachically, what do we say about this donkey? So according to this Mishnah in Bechorot, you could eat it, because we don't care, it seems, from the Mishnah simply, that that which derives from a thing, it has shared the status of that thing. So the cow is tahor, the child of that cow is a derivative, a yotzei of that original animal, and so it gets the status of the original animal. So it's a donkey with the halachic status of a cow, and it's mutter to eat, and you're allowed to eat it. The reverse is also true. If a cow gives birth and all of a sudden it's a sheep, oh sorry, a donkey gives birth and it's a sheep, you have the same problem in the reverse, and you would not be able to eat it. The Mishnah qualifies it and says, well, not everything counts as yotzei, right? So when an animal gives birth to another animal, that's clearly deriving in some sense from the original animal, right? This is a product of the cow, called a donkey, but it's really a cow, halachically. But if you, let's say, kill a fish, cut it open, and inside the belly there's another fish. So we know that that fish wasn't a product of the first fish. You know, so if a fish eats a crab, and you cut open the fish, you find the crab isn't a product. It's not yotzei from the fish. So the status there differs a little bit. But that leaves us with a potential potential model. So we think about yotzei mina tahor tahor, yotzei mina tamei tamei. So that would be a little bit more likely to prohibit, let's say, from a pig, you know, taking cells from a pig, if that's yotzei, well, they should have the status of that pig. But taking cells from a tahor animal, a cow, should have the status of a cow, and that might be a sort of driving principle here, that the cells might, by default, sort of belong to the category from which they originally came and be modeled after them. But there's one final limitation that some poskim might raise. We'll read it together, but while we are, I'll ask you to think of why maybe this isn't necessarily a great paradigm. This is source number 5. Right, so we'll discuss why you might argue that this is relevant to the world of lab-grown meat, and you'll tell me why it's not actually relevant to the world of lab-grown meat. So this is a quote from a Gemara in Yevamot. The context of that Gemara is a wife of a Kohen. A Bat Kohen. So daughter of a Kohen. She grew up, she was allowed to eat truma, right, the food that's given, the tithes that are given to the Kohen. She gets married to Yisrael, so she can't eat truma anymore. But if her husband dies, she could go back to eating truma because she sort of reverts to her father's house. Now, what happens if she gets married and she becomes pregnant and then her husband dies? So, it's according to this Gemara, it depends on the status of the fetus. Until 40 days in the gestational period, the fetus is considered, according to this Gemara, ad arbaim maya be'almahi. It is mere water. So her status until those 40 days is as a woman who does not have a child or did not become pregnant. After those 40 days, now the fetus is sort of recognized as a real thing. And if it's recognized as a real thing, a real fetus, so now she's considered pregnant and her status is now fully grounded in her husband's lineage and she no longer is allowed to eat truma. The details aren't as important for us right now, but the principle is a fetus until 40 days of development is considered mere water. It has no essential status. has some ramifications for abortion issues as well, abortion before 40 days and after 40 days. You may have more leniency to work with based on a Gemara like this. And so, the theory goes, you could take a cells from a fetus of a cow and use those to develop meat. And that fetus is just water. So, water isn't usser, water is pariv. So you take that, it's water. Maybe it's, you know, meat water, because it's from inside a cow, so maybe it's bisari, but it should certainly be kosher, and you probably avoid the Avermin Achai issue, because it's not an Aver. It's just water. That shouldn't be a big deal. Okay, so why is this not necessarily a helpful paradigm for us, right? How could a posik push back on this if they were trying to tell me that this is poor evidence?
Pregnancy and people, pregnancy and animals, completely different
law. Right? It could be pregnancy and people and animals is completely different. You can't borrow from one to the
it's
other.
No, but like, I mean, it's the, like, for cautious implications, like, if you shuck the cow and you find some sort of fetus inside of it, right, typically, we know Darabanan, it's still considered fleshing, even because of issues in Maris Hayan. But, Doraisa, it's part, because it's just like a random thing that's in your cow, and you can eat it. But, so...
Well, Mar and I is an issue we're going to touch on, you know, very briefly at the end, but it's not an essential issue.
Those types of, like, the halakha, halakha pertaining to kashrus and pregnancy are not related at all.
Right, so the argument you're making, which I'm, if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying any evidence from humans isn't going to be applicable to animals necessarily. Mm-hmm. So whatever counts as, you know, Maya Ba'alma or not Maya Ba'alma maybe is irrelevant. You may also argue physiologically, right? The state of development of a human fetus at 40 days might be very different than the state of an animal at 40 days. Right?
Gestation period is totally different.
Right, so it would be hard to tell when the... Okay, now the fetus is, you know, a real being as opposed to before when it wasn't. It would be hard to draw that line. Maybe people who raise animals might know, but it would be difficult to make that comparison kind of one-to-one. Other limitations?
This is also taking a bas koyin out of the status of being able to eat truma. So that's the only semblance of food being involved in this. This is not talking about that the fetus would be food and we would be thinking about it like that. Like, this is not, it's two totally different topics.
Right. So forget the human animal, you know, discontinuity, but also the context discontinuity, right?
Spiritual context versus physical.
Like, right. Or, you know, is the question like, is this fetus a fetus? That, you know, so until 40 days it might not be a fetus, but it's still, maybe you'd say it's still part of you, right? It still has the status of, let's say, the mother at this time. And so it would be hard to say, oh, now you can take from the fetus, and because it's just mere water, therefore it's not Avermin Achai. Yeah? Right? Maybe until 40 days it's even more, you know, part of the mother. Maybe it's even more likely to be Avermin Achai. So it would be hard to make that extension as well.
Like, yeah, there might be more leniency. Like, in terms of, like, abortion, for example, like, yeah, there might be more leniency before 40 days, but you still just can't choose to abort. Like, we consider the fetus to be, like, a thing. You can't just choose to abort it,
That's one opinion.
Majority of opinions hold that you can't just do that. Without, obviously.
Right, so,
we don't even really hold by this, even with human fetus.
Right, you know, the formulation, mere water, that's a very extreme formulation.
Yeah.
But is it really reflective of how we treat this entity? Might not be so clear. You know, we certainly, in like the strict physical sense, it's not mere water. So that already breaks down the comparison a little bit, even if the language is used that way. Because, I mean, it's insignificant until this point. Until 40 days is not, you know, substantial enough to be considered or to be weighted. Okay. That's all one factor. You already see how even any individual factor, like what is the status of this particular cell right now, might be something that, you know, kind of trips up post-skim. Next section, we won't read the sources inside, but the second question we'll have to answer is, are cells too small to count? So I'll ask you to all do an experiment with me. Everyone please take a deep breath in. Okay? Now swallow. You've all just consumed hundreds of millions of bacteria. That may be an exaggeration. Lots of bacteria. And I'll tell you what, those bacteria do not have split hooves, and they do not chew their cud, and they don't have fins and scales. So what are you doing? You just ate an incredible amount of trafe. That was awful.
No, breathing them, not eating them.
Well, I just had to swallow also, so that was how I avoided that.
But you
right?
Can't see them, so they're irrelevant.
Bingo, right? So source number six is Aruch HaShulchan. Aruch HaShulchan says, hold on a second. You look at water with a microscope, you see tons of little critters in there. You look at the air with a microscope, you can see tons of living creatures. So where exactly to draw the line becomes very important for people, right? Because there are lots of bugs that are hard to see with your physical eye, but you could see them. Right, so ones that are so small that under no circumstance are visible to the naked eye, I think most Poskim would agree to tell you that. Now, here's, the reason, let's say, I think the CRC, in Chicago, we got to represent, the CRC, I think, would tell you that there are some bugs that if you look really closely, you actually can see them. It's hard, but it's not that they're beyond your perception without a magnifying glass. And so perhaps we have to worry about bugs of different sizes, and they have their whole set of appropriate standards for how to search for each set of bugs. But the principle, I think, is an agreed-upon principle. There's something so small that it's imperceptible, but nobody argues about bacteria, right? If you eat a piece of meat and there's bacteria on it, nobody says you've just eaten treif. So maybe cells are so small, they don't exist. So you take a couple of cells, you put them into an incubation thing, but they're not really there. And then they grow, and all of a sudden, a steak appears. I don't know if they can do steaks yet. I think maybe they're able to do, sort of the equivalent of ground beef. I don't know if they're able to do.
The second that you take something out of an animal, this is coming from the animal. The second you take it out and it's in a syringe, you have no something about where it came from or what it is.
Okay, so, right, here's the pushback, right? If every one of these points is going to have a counterpoint. So, point in favor is, they're so small they don't count, so therefore you can do whatever you want with them. Counterpoint is, you're going to tell me that you used science to extract this thing that you know is there, that you are intentionally manipulating and using to create a product, and you're going to tell me, no, that's not really there halakhically. That's crazy, right? So the example here in source number 7 is from a position of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Rav Shlomo Zalman's talking about also a kind of gene editing. I'm not sure exactly what he means by his terminology. He's talking about genetic engineering, specifically in the context of plants. Can you sort of create a hybrid plant? And it's so microscopic, it doesn't matter if you're working on the level of DNA. And he says, of course you can't do that. Here I am actively manipulating this thing. Right? It's one thing to say it's so small, it's beyond my awareness or beyond my ability to do anything about, fine. But if you're going to say that here's this product that I'm working with, that I'm engaging with, and to say that it doesn't count because it's really small, hard to say. So a lot of the more stringent postgame here are going to point to Rav Shlomo Zalman or point to that kind of argument and say, you can't say it's so small it doesn't count because you are using this small thing and intentionally engaging and manipulating it. So that kind of argument doesn't even work. I happen to find that persuasive, right? I'm not going to weigh in on every one of these debates because some of them are beyond my pay grade. This one feels very persuasive to me. It's so hard to imagine that it's small and you're, intentionally manipulating it and it still is considered halakhically insignificant. Another factor we'll have to weigh is how the process of developing these cells, right? So we have the cells, right? We've gotten them from the animal, whatever status they might have until now. And already at this point, we may have totally invalidated them. They might be, pig legamre. They might be Abram Minachai completely. But even so, maybe there's a way to salvage this process. And the argument goes along the lines of what Rav Ovadia here is saying in source number 8. Rav Ovadia Yosef is dealing in this tshuva with gelatin. We're not dealing with gelatin fully, but it's a big debate as to whether the process of turning animal products into gelatin is sufficiently transformative that the connection between the animal products that were and the gelatin that is now is broken. So Rav Ovadia Yosef, and I think it's much more common in Israel than it is in America, so many Israeli poskim would agree with this as well, says, no, the process by which you take, let's say, the bones of this animal and you crush them and grind them and treat them with chemicals, at some point they're new. They aren't actually bones anymore. They have no relationship to the bones that came before. They're fully dried out for several months, and then you've turned them all by grinding them by chemical manipulation into powder. At this point, panim chadashot ba'ulakan. That's a great line, kind of representing this idea. It is a new creation. You've created a new entity that is not bone anymore. Yeah, bone was one of the ingredients. It's true, but this isn't bone that's been treated in certain ways. It's just gelatin. It's just its own thing. Now, a lot of American post-game, I think it's more or less the common minhag in America to not rely on gelatin produced from non-kosher animals. But you have this argument to rely on, and that might be one side in favor of using meat like this.
Can I ask, so the kosher gelatin that we're familiar with is not
it's made from fish.
It's usually made from fish.
It's fish gelatin.
No, it's not.
It's fish gelatin, right.
Yeah, fish is much more common. Okay. Theoretically, if you wanted it to be made from cow, you could, but that would be then subject to a debate as to whether it should be flacious or not.
Yeah. So there's one brand of kosher beef gelatin that's considered functional and actually kosher, according to the OU.
Really?
I don't know if it's considered PARV, actually. It was a whole discussion, because my father-in-law works for the OU. He's like their travel guy. And he goes around the world looking at factories.
Very cool.
Yeah, very cool. And so we were talking about it because one of my husband's friends married into a family, and her father gives hashgacha on beef gelatin. It's a little bit iffy under this kind of thing, which is not considered a functional psak by most people in the States. And so it was brought up because my father-in-law was like, oh, that sounds familiar. Is it the same family? And my husband asked, and the answer was yes. But
unsurprising.
Yeah.
Okay, but it's always good to have the insider kosher knowledge.
But there's one.
There's
brand,
one brand. Okay. I wonder when it's ever useful to have like a Flachix gelatin. Like I'm trying to think what product I would make that.
Pacha.
Pacha, you're right. That's probably the only thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, but if you're interested in that, then you have that option. People might still be eating, so we should probably talk about it afterwards. All right, so you have the gelatin star to rely on, but yeah, we wouldn't say gelatin's uncontroversial, so you don't want to necessarily go that route as your...
No, it's aspic. No,
beef
jello.
I know, I understand.
There's no live things.
They're not live. You have jellied feet also. I don't know if that's the same thing as pshat or not. Okay, so one avenue of the way that process could change things is by turning it into a new product. Another avenue was one we mentioned already, which is the avenue of bittul. Right? It could be that you have some cells. Those cells are nullified in other cells. So even if the cells were originally prohibited, at this point, they might be permitted. So bittul could be a possible avenue. Bittul's not going to get you as far as you'd like. For, I think, a couple of reasons, including one delightfully paradoxical one that we'll get to at the end. That's a spoiler. It's really, really interesting, but we'll get there in just a minute. So where does bittul not get you? So it doesn't need to get you very far because of the Ramah in source number 9. Because of a principle called Davar HaMa'amid. So gelatin is actually a very nice example, but it would really be true for things like rennet or any other sort of chemical coagulants. A Davar HaMa'amid is basically a certain part of the food that gives it some essential property. Exactly what counts as a ma'amid is far too detailed for where we are now, but for example, right, rennet would be a great example. So rennet is what you use to turn milk into cheese. It's what helps the cheese coagulate and become solid, or if you're into runny cheese, you could do that. But it's what turns the milk from liquid into cheese. So rennet is a classic example of something that, if it was not kosher, you can't say, oh, the rennet is batel in all the milk, because you put it there so that it has a relevant, noticeable impact on the product that you have. So if the argument of bittul is it's so insignificant as to be nullified, clearly this is not insignificant. This is the most significant thing. It wouldn't be cheese if I didn't put the rennet in. And certainly for the case of these cells, it wouldn't be beef or wouldn't be lamb if I didn't put in the cells from these animals. They're essentially what I want in order to create the final product. So it's very hard to argue that bittul is going to be a promising avenue here. And even more so, I think, for a reason that Rav Yaakov Ariel articulates in source number 10. He's the first contemporary posek that we've seen written on the page. He wrote an essay in this journal called Tchumen, where a number of the first essays about this topic came to print. He was a stringent view on these issues, for reasons that we'll see. He basically argues, bittul, it's the wrong category to be invoking here. Lania dati kola dion shel bitul barov lo relevanti le'inyanenu. I love Hebrew words that are English words. It's not relevanti to what we're talking about. Ki ha iser asmo mit rabe v'chol ayotzi mimenu asur kamohu v'ein kan bitul b'davar acher. You've totally misconceptualized this mixture, right? Some of the lenient views say things like, oh, you have a couple of cells, you add the cells to all of these other agents and proteins and chemicals, and that turns into this new thing called meat. Rebecca Royal says, what are you talking about? You put in two cells, and then the cells just grow. They just become more of the same thing, right? When you take a cow and you feed it grass, you don't say, I've made a mixture of cow and grass that's walking around now and mooing. It's still the same cow. It's just you fed it. So the same thing with the cells. You have cells. You feed them with whatever nutrients you're feeding them with. They multiply and multiply, and they become muscle tissue. But you haven't changed the identity of the thing. It's not bittle and something else. It's the same thing, just more of it. And then maybe the second cells are yotzi from the first cell, so they have the same status as the first cells. You may make an argument along those lines. Here's one area, by the way, where the manufacturing process might actually matter, because it's one thing to say that a muscle cell that I got multiplies and becomes more muscle cells and they're all the same. If I start with a stem cell and it becomes a muscle cell, maybe there's been an important transformation here. And a stem cell maybe has a different status than the muscle cells that come from it. Oh, the more extreme example is one we've mentioned already, right? You take a hair cell and turn it into a muscle cell. Completely different. I've turned it from not food to food. So, you know, at some point in the process, you might have enough discontinuity from the original status to the meat you've created at the end, you may be able to get to a certain kind of leniency here. So a lot of these approaches or these issues that we've seen so far have to do with, okay, I'm taking the cell, I'm manipulating it. What is the role of the cell? How does the manipulation work? There are a couple of really curious side issues, I should say. Right? They're on a different avenue. They're thinking a little bit differently than the ones we've seen before. So, for example, should we jump past source number 11? No, let's read source number 11. It's important, right? Could be that we're totally barking up the wrong tree, and when we look at lab-grown meat, we're actually lying. It's not really meat, or it's not really basar in the halakhic sense. So you have a paradigm. It appears two slightly similar places in the Gemara and Sanhedrin. One is in Sanhedrin Daf Nun Tet. It's in the context of discussing Adam HaRishon and whether he was able or not able to eat meat or what kind of meat he was or was not eating. We did vegetarianism a while back. You could circle back to that if you like. At some point, the Gemara suggests that maybe Adam HaRishon was eating meat that came from heaven. Wow, what does that mean, meat that comes from heaven? Oh, here's a story. So what happened was, Rav Shimon ben Chalafta haveka azil ba'orcha, he was traveling, pagu bo hanach aryavata, he was attacked by lions, zavu ka naham el ape, and quote the pasuk can tell him, but nechidu le tarte atmeta, chada achlua v'chada shavkua. But luckily, two thighs of an animal descended, and they fed the animal. So they fed the lions, and Rav Shimon ben Chalafta was able to leave. Then he got to the Beit Midrash, aitu ava'ata le Beit Midrasha, Bayala davar tame huze o davar tahor. Said this meat came from heaven. Is it tame or is it tahor? And the Gemara answered, or the Beit Midrash answered, ein davar tame yori min hashamayim. If it came down from heaven, can't be tame. That's not possible. So that's interesting, right? You have this piece of meat. Normally, you find a piece of meat on the street, don't eat it for lots of reasons, but including for kashrus reasons. But here, if it comes from heaven, we know. It can't possibly be not kosher meat. It must be kosher to eat.
What if it just falls from the sky?
So you have to read in this Gemara. What's going on?
How to make it part.
Oh, very good. So how did the meat get there? Did God create the meat in heaven and it rained down? Or maybe it just blew really hard and there was a tornado? Could be. You have different options here.
Tornadoes where it rains frogs. Are those frogs kosher?
No comment. No, there's a Gemara Menachot I didn't see before preparing the source sheet, but it's relevant here also, that talks about wheat that comes from heaven and whether you could use that wheat for various kinds of korbanot. That's going to be relevant when we talk very briefly at the end about some of the contemporary views here. But this idea of sort of miracle meat is one that's very appealing to some poskim, including Rav Shechter. And based on sources like this, the source like the Malbim, source number 12, he suggests maybe the idea of miracle meat is actually different than, you know, cow meat or animal meat. In the sense that meat that comes from animals is all the status of meat that we normally know and love. Miracle meat works differently. The Baal then brings this example in the context of a story in Chumash when Avraham, feeds the three malachim. He brings them curds and milk and the meat that he made. So that should be a problem. Why is he feeding them treif? But and yeah, all you'll tell me is before the Torah was given, but all the Midrashim assume that Avraham kept the Torah, so you can't say that.
Well, there's the Durabanan. The whole we don't eat meat and milk together is because of Durabanan.
So, very good, but the Gemara in Yoma says that Avraham even kept Durabanans, and he was even davening Mincha using Erevin. So,
the Malachim weren't an Ashim, so therefore they're not kind of the Torah.
But he didn't know that, so
yeah, but
he did.
So we have to ask the question, did Avram know that they were angels or not know they were angels, which is a fine partial new question. Maybe that's okay. But Malvin says something different. He says, the meat wasn't really meat. He used a book called Sefer Yetzirah, which is Chazal's equivalent of a book of magical spells. It's a book that we have a book called Sefer Yetzirah, which seems to be a sort of Kabbalistic or mystical book. But he took this book and he was able to create a calf, that he then prepared and served to the angels. And the calf that he was prepared, because it was created by magic and not by another calf, was not real meat. And so they could eat it together with milk. And then he says, but that's a bad pshat. The real pshat is probably that he like served the dairy first and then afterwards served the meat. And it says in the Pasuk, he first served them the curds and the milk and then the meat comes after. So that's not so hard to say. But the theory that he embraces, which is endorsed by at least a couple of halakhic sources also, not presented on these sources, maybe leads you to the conclusion that, well, we should look at clean meat or lab meat as the same as magic meat. It should be the exact same halachic status as that. And Rav Schachter at YU thinks that. And I think the way I saw it presented, I haven't had the chance to talk to Rabbi Ganak from the OU yet, but I think the way I saw it presented is that he originally thought that was going to be OU policy, that magic meat and lab meat would be part of, until he changed his mind for some reason. And we'll see why. Maybe you might not like this source so much. As a basis for a leniency. But this is Rav Schachter's view. He seems to think that you could take lab-grown meat and it would be parv, right? It's not meat. There's no relationship to that which came before. So there are at least three reasons to push back. Rav Asher Weiss, who is the second person in the picture on the front page, has at least three reasons to push back on this proof. First of all, he'll tell you, that's an agadata. That's like a malbim on chumash. Like, you're going to open a Chumash and read a Rashi or Ibn Ezra and say, I'm going to paskan halacha based on that? You can't do that. That's an agadah to Gemara, and all the Gemaras that talk about creating animals with magic, they're all agadahs. They're not real halacha. And you can't learn real halacha from, you know, agadic or non-halachic statements. The second thing you could say is that, well, he has agadahs one way, I have agadahs the other way. I mentioned there's a Gemara in Menachot about wheat that rains down from heaven and that you could use that, or you might be able to use that for various korbanot. Well, you could use it for various korbanot. It's a real, you know, kind of wheat. So, sounds like that's real, right? It's not that wheat from heaven is also not wheat, the same way that magic cows are not cows. So, once you have contradictory sources in a gadata, so that's very difficult to sort of come to one conclusion. That's the second reason why you might oppose this kind of reading. And what was Rashi Weiss's third reason? It was a very good reason as well.
I mean, it's not magic.
Yeah, it's not magic, thank you. It's not magic, it's science, right? We're not, like, using incantations. We're using DNA, we're using cells, we're using a well-defined scientific process that will hopefully become more well-defined over time. And you know what? It's not magic. It's a real, normal product of normal human ingenuity. So it should definitely be considered meat. He also has other reasons to consider it meat. I think he sort of intuitively assumes, like, if it looks like meat and it smells like meat, it's meat. So you can't just pretend that it's not for all sorts of fancy halakhic reasons. Like, you have to be a sort of halakhic realist about it. We'll summarize very briefly last couple of perspectives. Here's the paradox I alluded to before. There's a halacha in the Shulchan Aruch called In Mevatlin Isser Lechachila. Right? We talked about bittul before. So whatever bittul does for you, you can't do it intentionally. So you can't put a little milk into your cholent. I want to stretch out my cholent a little bit, so I'll put a couple drops of milk in. Nope, that cholent becomes treif. Even though the milk is very negligible compared to the meat, it's less than 1/60th, you don't taste it, nonetheless, the cholent becomes treif at that point. And it's not only treif for you, it's also treif for the person you did that for. So let's say you're cooking for your family, no one in your family can eat that cholent. You could bring it to my house, and I would love to eat that cholent, but it would be usher for you to eat. Rabbi Akiva Eger, in source number 15, goes one step further, and he says, if you do it for someone else, even if they don't know that you did it, it's problematic. And if you do it for sale, then it's problematic to anyone you might sell it to. So you can't make a cholent shop, which would be a great idea, and start being mevatel milk into your cholent and then selling it to people, because you did it for us. You did it to create the product that you're selling to all the people who are buying your product. Based on this, there's been a suggestion, which I think is just delightful, that there could be a kind of lab-grown meat that would be kosher, but only if nobody certified it. Why? Because once you certify it, you're telling me that you're creating this product for the kosher market. So any bittel that you're doing, if you're relying on any kind of bittel, now you're doing that bittel for the kosher consumer. And if you're doing the bittel for the kosher consumer, we're not allowed to consume it. But if it's not certified, you're not making it for the kosher consumer. That would mean that it is kosher.
But that's not a bidyevet case. What if the person who took the cells out of the cow was a Jewish guy? He did it on purpose. That's what that's
about. So that might be also for him, right? But not necessarily for us as a result. Like, there are two pieces here. There's the prohibition to do it, and there's the prohibition to eat it afterwards. And I think most of these companies, you have companies in Israel who are leading this, but...
Just because it's not certified, it's
kosher. Right, because it's not certified, it is kosher, but only if you know, right? You, right, it's tricky, because you need enough people to not know that, so that by not certifying it, it's clear you're not putting it in the kosher market.
But once you tell people, hey, we're deliberately not certifying this, so that it is allowed to be consumed by you guys, haven't you defeated the purpose? Because...
Correct. That would probably be the equivalent of certification.
So how are you going to get the... Right. You basically... So how are you going to get the word out?
Okay, I'm not saying this is good business policy, okay? This is bad policy. It's just a funny halakhic possibility.
Don't rely on paradox.
It's a good loophole, but I can't say it.
Very puzzling loophole. Would not recommend it, but... And also, look, what you also could do is it could be very altruistic, right? Like, I could go to a facility... and say, I don't want to look around and make sure things are kosher. I'm never going to tell anyone. But anyone who doesn't know halacha and does eat it won't be violating any yisurim because it happens to be kosher and no one knows about it. So they think they're doing the wrong thing, but they're actually doing the right thing.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. But that's why I had to share it. Okay, so just to recap what we've seen and all of the essential issues... And there are more essential issues to go beyond here, but we have our three main questions, right? Take lab-grown meat. Can you make it lab-grown pork from a pig? Most poskim would say no. You have some voices, mostly in Israel, who are more okay with it. Most poskim are saying no. In the sense of like yotzei min hatameh, right? We talked about that source. It's sort of at least a pork derivative, if not pork itself. And we're not comfortable with the processes that sort of turn the cells into nothing and then back into something. That seems to not be so widely accepted. Could you take cells from a live animal? Seems to be that it would be very similar. Seems to be you'd have the same problem with the cells being problematic in and of themselves, and then trying to turn them into some kosher illicit product is a too dicey or difficult a process, so we're not necessarily so on board with that. Again, you have voices in favor of that kind of possibility. That's not a problem that's, I think, is so difficult. I don't think it's so hard to start your manufacturing with shechting one cow and creating a functionally limited supply of meat, right? The pure, you know, ethical vegans would tell you you can't even do that. But to shecht one cow to ensure the entire kosher community always stops eating shechted meat might be a trade-off that's worth making. So you could work that out. And the third issue, which is the juiciest one, it's not even a pun. I was about to say pun not intended, but that's not very disappointing. The question of par over fleishigs, right? So that's a real live debate that's still going on, right? If Schechter thinks it's magic, miracle meat, it's not, shouldn't be fleishigs at all. Even if you had reason to say it was fleishigs, there might be other mitigating factors like bittel, like the various transformative processes that might make it pariv. You had some poskim in America who thought gelatin made from cow bones could be pariv. So you have that line of thinking. On the other hand, you have some, you might call them halachic realists, who say, look, if it looks like a cow and it smells like a cow, looks like beef, smells like beef, it's beef. All the fancy bittel doesn't work. All of your fancy svaras are not so compelling. But the product is still a good choice for many of the reasons we outlined at the beginning, but has no halachic advantage over some of these other products. Source number 16, we won't read inside, raises the idea of maradayin, which is an important one. Just 1 second, I see the hand. Even if you would argue that it is pariv, like Rav Schechter argues, like the Chief Rabbi of Israel argues, as well as many other Israeli poskim and some other poskim in America, it might be a little while before lab-grown meat becomes ubiquitous enough that I could expect that you're eating it and not worry when I see you eating a cheeseburger. So it might be that you need to either advertise it specially, right? The chief rabbi of Israel in that article that someone sent said, it's meat, but you can't advertise it as meat. Meaning, sorry, it's pariv, as long as you don't advertise it as meat. If you advertise it as beef-like, you know, ethical product or something, then you're fine. But if you advertise it as meat, it would run into various marat ayin type issues. And I'll leave the last verse also, but, you know, the certain people who are thinking about doing the lab-grown pork have this little midrash to quote. It's a nice way to end. It's a cute midrash about how a chazir is called a chazir because one day it will chozer to be kosher again. And a lot of the poskim who are trying to be lenient are pointing to a midrash like this and saying, wouldn't it be great to expand our palate? And, you know, the more Zionist you are, the more okay you are with thing. We're approaching the end of days, so we have more expectation that certain things like this might be happening. So it's a very creative, but also very exciting time to be watching some of these halakhic issues really playing out. We have one more question, I think.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if Mars Lion is a consideration.
Absolutely it is. Absolutely it is. And there are even some poskim who say it should be treated as meat, but maybe we should be less machmir. So meat, but maybe you don't need to wait 6 hours afterwards. Or however long you wait. Because it's not real meat, but there's a marat ayin concern eating them together. But if you eat a burger for lunch and 2 hours later you buy an ice cream, nobody's going to say boo. So there are various, you know, marat ayin issues are easier to solve, right? Even just having clear labeling and marketing might be enough.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to stop.